Today's Teisho will be on Case 14 in the Book of Serenity, Attendant Wall Passes Tea. Introduction. Probing, pole in hand, shadowing grass around him, sometimes he wraps a ball of silk in iron, sometimes he wraps a special stone with silk. To determine the soft by means of the hard is of course right. What about the matter of being weak when needing strength? Case. Attendant Wall asked Deshan, "Where have all the sages gone since antiquity?" Deshan said, "Huh? What's that?" Wall said, "I just ordered a flying dragon, but a lame turtle has shown up." Deshan let it rest. The next day, when Deshan came out of the bathhouse, Wo passed him some tea. Deshan patted Wo on the back. Wo said, "This old fellow has finally gotten a glimpse." Again, Deshan let the matter rest. Verse. Coming right up face to face, an old adept knows. Here sparks and lightning are slow. The plotter who lost the moment has a deep intent to fool the enemy army into not thinking ahead. Each shot is a sure hit. Who's fooled anymore? When you see jowls from behind his head, the man is hard to run afoul of. Seeing his eyes under his eyebrows, he got the advantage. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning. Once again, the ventilation system has surprised us. If you were here last time, it was freezing cold. And no matter what I set the thermostat, no matter how low I set the thermostat, high I set the thermostat, the temperature was below 68 degrees. So today, no matter how low I set the thermostat, it's about 78 degrees in here. So it gives us something to practice with. Thank you for coming, and let's enjoy this beautiful heat. If it's going to be hot, we might as well enjoy it. Right? So here's the koan today. Attendant Wo asked Deshan, "Where have all the sages since antiquity gone? What has happened to all the great sages of antiquity?" Now, if you've been practicing Zen for a while, you know what kind of question this is, right? This is the kind of question that we ask when we take ideas and words a little too seriously. So it's a sort of a philosophical question. Now, where have all the sages since antiquity gone? Right? So perhaps Deshan could say they've gone to Tusita heaven. Perhaps you could say they've returned to the source. You know, those kinds of answers are just as bad as those kinds of questions. They're merely words, right? Attendant Wall was asking Deshan a kind of an abstract philosophical question. Where have all the sages since antiquity gone? Deshan said, "Huh? What was that?" So it's like, I wasn't even paying attention. What did you say? So this is a sort of a put down, or maybe just sort of an unexpected answer, right? Maybe Attendant Wo wanted Deshan to say, they have returned to the source. See? And instead Deshan says, "Huh? What was that?" So Wo was, it's hard to tell exactly, but Wo seems a little ticked off. He says, "You know, you're supposed to be a great Zen master, and I've asked you this question, and I was waiting for a flying dragon to show up, but all I see in front of me is a lame turtle, right? And then Dishon doesn't, he just, it tells us Dishon let it rest. The next day, when Dishon came out of the bath, taking his daily shower, Wol passed him some tea. See, so something's going on with Wol, see? It's like he was mad at Dishon yesterday for not taking his questions, his philosophical questions seriously. And but today, Dishon's coming out of the bathroom, he's had his afternoon shower, just as we do during a session. And Wol passes him some tea, like to make up, or to show him that I'm not angry anymore. Dishon pats him on the back, like, it's okay, don't worry. And Wol says, this old fellow, in other words, I have gotten a glimpse of something. Thanks to what you showed me yesterday, I have a glimpse of something. Again, Dishon let the matter, Dishon doesn't say, oh, that's great, you know, I'm glad you finally, just let the matter rest. So when Wol was angry and disappointed, Dishon let the matter rest. When Wol was happy and Dishon let the matter rest. So this is, I think, just a wonderful, wonderful koan. You might not have noticed this in the paper, but I have a lot of friends who know I'm involved in Zen. And whenever there's anything like in the New York Times on Buddhism, or, you know, they all email me the article. So earlier this week there was an article on Buddhism, a rather lengthy article in the New York Times, and about three people I know emailed it to me. And then when I got home, my wife said Carol brought this from down the street, and I opened it up, and it was the article again. So I'm very glad to have friends like that. And I'm very grateful for their wanting to share this with me. It was an interesting article because it involves the New York, I think it's called the New York Buddhist Church. And that seems kind of odd, right, to say Buddhist Church. But there is indeed in New York a New York Buddhist Church, and if you go to Chicago, there's a Chicago Buddhist Church, and there are many in California, and they have an interesting history because they were started almost a century ago by Japanese immigrants to the United States. When they arrived in the United States, they wanted to create a more American kind of religious life for themselves. So they stopped calling it a temple or mountain, and they started to call it a church. And they have a well-established facility in New York, as they do in these other major cities, and as I say, especially along the West Coast, in Oregon, and in Seattle, where I grew up, there was a Seattle Buddhist Church. And they have an interesting history, not only here in the United States, but in Japan as well, because this Seattle Buddhist Church is associated with the Jodo Shinshu. This is pure land Buddhism. This is what's known as pure land Buddhism, and this is Japanese pure land Buddhism. The article was quite interesting because it was saying that in the New York Buddhist Church and in Buddhist churches around the country, these pure land Buddhist temples, the teachers have started to introduce Zazen, meditation of the kind that we do. And this might not seem very important, but it's really quite an important development in the history of Japanese Buddhism. Because Japanese Buddhism is a little different from Chinese Buddhism in its historical development. Chinese tend to have a very they tend to have a very flexible outlook, in my experience. So when Zen reached its peak in the Tang Dynasty and the Sung Dynasty, there was also a Pure Land Buddhism in China. And they were the two big schools of Buddhism in China, Zen or Chan and Pure Land. And they were separate in their development for a long time, but after the Sung Dynasty, they blended together. So that if you went to a Pure Land temple on the mainland, often people recited scriptures, recited sutras, and recited Amitabha, at the same time also did Chan, also did Zen meditation. So in a way, as Buddhism developed in China, these two rivers flowed together, these two great streams of Pure Land and Chan and Zen. But in China, that's the Chinese case. In Japan, things were very different. Because in the, maybe 700 years ago, just about 700 years ago, the greatest figure in Japanese Pure Land lived, named Shinran. And Shinran originally trained with Zen monks, and also Tendai priests. And he did Zazen forever and ever. Right? I mean, he threw himself into Zazen and practiced Zazen day and night with great determination. But Shinran was very disappointed by the Zen world in Japan. I think this is such an interesting story, and it's very important to think about this little story, in my opinion. Because Shinran was a person who had an excellent heart. His motive was very much compassion, and he wanted to get out of his personal hell. And he was practicing Zazen with some of the greatest Zen masters of his time. And he was very disappointed by Zen, by the Zen experience. One of the things that bothered him very much was the what you could call the decadence of Zen at that time. Because at that time, Zen was regarded very highly in Japan. Zen masters were looked at the way we look at like nuclear physicists. You know? We used to have a couple of physicists in our sangha, and they were very nice people, Pradeep and Sahana. And they were not at all arrogant, or on the contrary, they were the very unassuming, really, I thought, wonderful people. But you know, if you're trying to find a job that everybody respects highly, that everybody thinks is the tip top of smartness, you know, if you say, "Oh, I'm in physics," especially if I'm in theoretical physics, it's like, "Oh my God, theoretical physics! You must be very smart indeed," you know. And indeed, they are very smart, right? You know? But the thing is, you know, people used to look at Zen masters that way in Japan. And when Shinran would go to these Zen temples, he would see these Zen masters, and they would come out to deliver a dokusan, deliver a teisho. And they would have beautiful silk robes, you know, beautiful, like, you know, $1 million Armani silk robes. And cloaks with brocade, you know, sort of like weighed down with all of this beautiful brocade. And they would give their lofty talks, right, and retire into their solitude and do their calligraphy or their flower arrangement. and you could hardly get to see them, right? And you could hardly understand what they were talking about, right? They would give these talks and you would think, you'd scratch your head and say, what the hell was that all about, you know? Just like today, probably doing the same thing. And Shinran was very disappointed because it seemed to him that really the Zen people were very arrogant and out of touch, you know. They loved to live this beautiful, lofty lifestyle, and they wear their beautiful robes and have their brocade capes and so on. And they sat for hours and would compete with each other. This was actually true. This was Hakuin Zenji later was quite unhappy with this too. He of course stayed in the Zen tradition, but at this time Zen practice became a route to power and authority. And so people who were ambitious gravitated to this, and they would compete in the Zendo. It's like everybody would try to sit full lotus for as long as possible, right? And you'd look over and think, oh my God, he's sitting full lotus for another, I've got to do another 20 minutes too, you know? And so it was like a competitive sitting arrangement, right? And people were competing to answer their koans. So, you know, somebody would, I've answered, you know, 1,000 koans. Well, I've answered 1,200. You know, so this could happen, right? I mean, this could happen. And it's important to understand that this can happen. You know, I love Zazen. I love Zen. This is my path with my whole heart. And I have never been disappointed by it, ever. If you just keep sitting, if you sit with an open heart, you won't be betrayed. I swear to you. But human beings are human beings, you know. And it's important to understand that even if you have a beautiful temple, and even if you have Zazen, and even if you have the whole system, it can still go off the tracks, you know? Human pride is very difficult to overcome. Human fear, human attachment, you know? So, you know, in these temples, people had taken some wrong steps. And so the temples were sort of like mountains of pride. And it was like, you know, if you don't do Zazen, you're not worth my time. You know, and if you don't, this doesn't seem like something the Buddha would have said. And we know the Buddha went out of his way to help everybody, irrespective of their economic situation, irrespective of their educational level. You know, when the Buddha was with uneducated people, he spoke to them in the most direct, unassuming, kindly manner. The record is clear. When he was with philosophers, he engaged with philosophers. When he was with the, you know, he addressed himself to the audience in the appropriate way, but he was extremely kind to people who had nothing. In fact, it's generally thought that the Buddha died from eating spoiled food that some very poor people had given him. And the belief is that he knew it was spoiled, but he ate it anyway out of kindness, and so ended his life a little more quickly than might have happened. So we know the Buddha didn't behave this way, but all the same, you know, human beings get confused. And, you know, roshis, people who have had daikensho, and people who get put on a pedestal for a long time can get a little confused, get a little too proud. And, you know, this is what happened. You know, people, if you have daikensho and you live in an ivory tower and you don't get out and deal with people the way the Buddha did, your awareness can become very incomplete. The daikensho isn't a personal quality. It's not like an achievement. It's not like a new robe you put on, right? Daikensho is reality. And so, you know, people stumble into that sooner or later. It's not their personal possession, and they can stumble out of it again. You know, you can stumble right out. And if you don't live the right kind of life after daikensho, you can get as confused as before daikensho. This is the truth. The Buddha himself had Daikensho when he was about 35 years old. And he continued to get up every day and do zazen. It's very important. He did this every day until he died, at 80, from eating spoiled food that was given to him by people who loved him and had nothing else to offer him. So anyway, at this period in the history of Japanese Zen, this was really like the period of decadence. And what Buddhism and what Zen are all about was really lost in a haze of egotism and confusion. And there really were people sort of sitting, trying to outsit their arrivals in the temple and struggling to answer their koans faster than others. You know, this was really going on. Shinran, who was really like a very compassionate person, he just exploded with rage about this. He just, at some point, he just said, "This is bullshit," you know. And he walked out of the temple, and he never walked back in. Shinran started doing things differently. He got married, he had children, and he said, "Listen, my job is to help the most powerless people in Japan, the people who have no other consolation." And basically, he practiced a kind of Pure Land Buddhism, which basically asks for help from, you could say, Amida, a Buddha of infinite light. This is a being, a human like Siddhartha, who was believed to have achieved enlightenment and made a special vow to help others. The belief among Pure Land people is that if you just ask Amida for help by reciting appropriate lines from the sutra, you will be helped, you will be saved. This is very much like Christianity, as a matter of fact. So basically, Shinran taught this doctrine, and he said, "Don't do zazen. Zazen is like the devil's path." Isn't that interesting? He said, "Those Zen priests are demons." He said, "Stay away from those guys." And so basically Shinran's teaching was, whenever you try to be better than you are, realize you're hopeless. Right? You're hopeless. So it all has to be what Western people would call like grace. Right? Divine grace has to save you. You can't save yourself. So whenever you're thinking, "I could get better, I can be a better person, I can do it, you know, I can be a little better than the next guy," no, you're hopeless, you're doomed. Yeah. See, this is very much like, Shinran's very much like Martin Luther. If you know something about the history of Western religion, this is exactly what Luther said. Don't even try to save yourself, can't be done. Yeah. So just give up and throw yourself on Amida's grace, on Amida's compassion. So, you know, this was a teaching of a Shinran, very different from Chinese Pure Land, which always had very good relations with this, with Chan. For all these years, 700 years, basically, there's been this big split. What's happening now is really, I think, pretty interesting. Because all of a sudden, in the United States anyway, people are coming to Buddhist churches, to Jodo Shinshu temples here in the United States, and saying, "We would like to have some Zazen instruction." And the leader of Pure Land, Japanese Pure Land Buddhism in the United States is a man whose last name is Ogui. Ogui, Sensei Ogui, and he basically realized that what had happened to Japanese Buddhist Church over the last 100 years is that their membership has declined every generation. So basically, they've lost 2/3 of their membership in the last 50 years since World War II. And he said that he would get, for every 10 calls he would get from people inquiring about his temple, eight of them would be about Zazen. So people would call up and say, is this the Seattle Buddhist Church? And he'd say, yes. Well, actually, he's in Chicago. So they say, is this the Chicago Buddhist Church? And he'd say, yes. And they say, I'd love to learn how to meditate. And he'd say, well, we don't do that. Click. Right? So he said, 8 out of every 10 people who called him, you know, were hanging up on him. And he said, I began to think if this were a business, I'd go out of business. Mm-hmm. So Ogwe, actually, his father was a very broad-minded priest in the Pure Land lineage in Japan. And he used to actually sit, do zazen, with a Rinzai teacher. So Ogwe grew up doing some zazen. Even though a Shinran had said, don't you do that zazen, you know, that's pride. You know. So Ogwe, his idea now is, let's go ahead and do some zazen. And let's do some zazen. This, and he's a very pleasant, very kindly man. He's very nice. You know. Their style is very different, you know. They just, whenever you feel insecure, whenever you feel like you're losing control, just lose control. It's okay, because it's like you can just fall because Amida is going to catch you. See, this is very much like Christianity. Just let yourself fall, because it's a very deep way of life, very beautiful way of life. But somehow, you know, for some reason, people want zazen. So Ogwe's idea is, well, why don't we do some zazen? So after 700 years, there's a kind of return. These two streams have come back together. And I think that's really a very wonderful development. I hope it takes root in Japan, too. I hope that this kind of friendship occurs in Japan. Maybe someday people who go to Jodo Shinshu temples will actually do some sitting. You know, I think that we're really at an interesting moment in history. I really do believe this, you know. Because I guess I could put it this way. You know, we have seen for maybe the last 2,000 years the rise of what might be called bhakti religion or devotional religion. You know, earlier religion across the world was based upon what you might call self-cultivation. So if you look at Judaism, for example, it's really based, there's a very strong collective dimension to it, but in my opinion, it's based upon making yourself ethically, transforming yourself ethically and spiritually through effort. You know, there's you have the law, the law of Moses, and you try to live according to that law, to those laws, and you make an effort, and sometimes you fail and sometimes you succeed, but you keep trying, you know. And I think in some ways the teachings of the Buddha were somewhat like that, you know, the idea that you have to make an effort, you have to try, you have to cultivate yourself. And of course, in China too, there was this same tradition of a kind of spirituality of self-cultivation, or self-cultivation. So in Confucianism, you know, you try to live according to certain basic principles, and you follow these principles very carefully and try to be a good human who has ren, right? Human compassion or humanness, ren. In Taoism too, you try to harmonize yourself with the universe, right? So these are all sort of like practices of cultivation. When we sit on the cushion, in a way, We're doing the same thing. We're trying to cultivate our minds and transform ourselves through our own efforts. And this is really, you see, all over the world at just about the same time. But after these religions arise, you see a kind of, I think all over the world, you see a kind of change at some point, where you get teachers like Jesus or people in Hindu tradition, and in Buddhism itself you get this change taking place, where teachers like Shinran come along and say, wait a minute, you know. There's something wrong with thinking that you can become perfect, you know, become perfect. You know, you're not perfect. And so the whole idea of trying to make yourself perfect is a kind of a fraud, kind of a sham. See? And so, basically, these are like, I'm calling them bhakti religions. They're based upon like devotion. Instead of trying to do it yourself, have devotion, be humble, and sort of give up, and let a higher power help you. See. And the idea behind all of these is that basically, no matter how, you know, Shinran used to say, no matter how much zazen you do, see, no matter how many hours of sitting you do, you're still going to be hopelessly imperfect. So Shinran basically said people are so imperfect that zazen will not help them. I think that's fascinating. I think that's fascinating. You know, this Shinran's psychology is interesting to me because I think he has a very important point. You know, if you're practicing a zazen in order to be perfect, you're going to be bitterly disappointed. Bitterly. And by the way, you know, it's easy enough to see that I'm not perfect. You know, so but if you think that the Dalai Lama is perfect, or someday you may be studying with some other teacher, and you might think, now this guy is perfect, right? Perfect. And indeed, there are people who even will tell you they're perfect, right? Those are the worst, by the way, right? If you ever run into a teacher who claims to be infallible, just turn and run away, you know, as fast as your legs, because that person is deep in a deep hell of self-delusion. Right? There are all kinds of people who make that claim all the time. You'll meet them all the time. You know? And indeed, if some people have had Daikensho, and they think that makes them perfect. You know, but not so. You know, so I think Shinran has a really important point. If you're practicing Zen to be perfect, you know, you can quit right now. I hope you won't, but if that's your goal, you're going to be deeply disappointed. And if you think that the teacher is perfect, you're going to be deeply disappointed. Often actually in Zen communities, this becomes a huge problem. Because, I had a teacher, Genki Roshi, who was really a fantastic person in many ways. And my second teacher, Webb Roshi, these people were fantastic. You know? And it's easy to put people like that on a pedestal. You know, when I met Genki Roshi, he just seemed so compassionate and so deeply awake that I was actually afraid to talk to him. I literally was just afraid to even get close to him because I just thought my imperfections were so obvious to him, you know, and I just felt so unworthy. That sounds ridiculous, but just opening my mouth, I felt was sort of like revealing my ignorance and my, I really did feel that way. So it was hard. One time I was walking down the street and I saw Genki Roshi coming in the other direction and I jumped into some shop, you know. It was out on University Avenue. I saw him coming. He didn't see me. I just jumped into the shop just automatically. and just didn't want him to see me. It's like, hide me, you know. Genki Roshi's perfection is coming down the street. And this happens in all kinds of communities, including Zen communities, where people are trying to become awake, and they see the teacher as like the embodiment of the highest values. And the teacher may even see himself or herself that way, you know. But this is like the road to disaster, because, you know, again and again in these communities, as you get closer to the teacher, you realize that this person is just a human. This person is still imperfect, right? This person is still imperfect. And this is, I mean, I'm, you know, in case you have any, as I say, it's pretty obvious that I'm imperfect. But you know, if you run into somebody someday who really knocks you off your feet, and you say, my God, that person, now there is perfect, no. You know, and when you get, sooner or later, that person is going to reveal to you a human side. You're going to see their pride. You're going to see their fear. You're going to see their, envy. You're going to see their anger. You're going to see their lust. And when that happens, if you look at the history of Zen communities in the United States, they often blow apart. It's just, it's like an earthquake. It's like, my God, the teacher is not Buddha, you know? And people get furious because they have put this person on a pedestal, and they can get, and I've seen it on several occasions, that people become furious. It's like, you phony, you know, you fraud. And this actually happened to Genki Roshi, who was a wonderful person. But Genki Roshi had a few flaws. You know, he was a human, he was deeply awake, but he had not worked out all of his karmic obstacles. And his were not terrible crimes, you know, he wasn't... Genki Roshi grew up in a temple. He never had to take care of himself. He was taken care of by the Buddhist establishment. His teacher, his Dharma father, told him when he was a little boy, he said, Genki, never worry about money. Never. All the money in the world belongs to you. The lay people are just holding it for you. And when you need it, all you have to do is ask. Right? Really? Isn't that amazing? He told that to Genki when Genki was a little boy. So, you know, when Genki needed money, he would just ask. And of course, you know, if the teacher says, listen, could you lend me $200? You think, oh, what an honor. The teacher's asking me for $200. Of course. And you rush to get it. You don't ever ask to get paid back. This is a Buddha, right? You wouldn't ask Buddha, hey, Buddha, where's that $200, you know? So, you know, it began to mount up. And, you know, Genki Roshi didn't know, really. He eventually did, because he started his own business. He changed a lot. But when he first came from Japan, he was a very unworldly monk, right? And he had never had a job. You know, he didn't have a bank account. This was all, you know, so it's like money. Isn't money everywhere? You know, doesn't it grow on trees? You know, everybody seems to have it, you know. And it began to be a real problem. It created, like, at one time, a crisis in our community. And people felt so betrayed. You know, I thought you were enlightened, you bad man. And it broke my heart, because Genki was enlightened. He was the sweetest man, I thought. I just thought he was the sweetest person. And he wasn't what I thought initially. He didn't walk on water. He didn't float in the sky, you know. He could be a kind of a pill, as we say. You know, he could be a pain in the ass sometimes. But on the whole, he was an extremely kind man who just had some flaws. But this hunger for perfection, is really a terrible sickness. Now, the thing is, I think Shinran is like a disappointed idealist, right? Shinran was a disappointed idea, because I think Shinran totally believed that Zazen was going to make you Buddha, right? Zazen is going to make you perfect. It's going to, and then, you know, when Shinran began to encounter people who weren't perfect, who were Roshis, and they weren't perfect. And he saw their pride. He saw their fear. He saw their envy. We have a wonderful expression in English. It's called throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? Yeah, throwing. And that's what Shinran did. It's like, if it's not perfection, then screw the whole thing, right? Why even sit if I'm not going to be perfect? See, why even go through here? This morning we've all been sitting here, it's 80 degrees in here, our legs are hurting. If it's not going to make us perfect, why the heck are we doing this, right? That's a Shinran's way of thinking, you know. And now I'm a little bit unfair, because Shinran's motive was to help ordinary people. He was a very compassionate person, but you know, I think he made a mistake. I think he was a disappointed idealist. He wanted perfection. See, and I don't think, I think perfection is just another illusion. You know, I think perfection is just another illusion that we have to sort of get beyond. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not perfect. The Dalai Lama isn't perfect. He's not. You know, I always dread the day when some scandal happens involving the Dalai Lama, you know? I'm sure it won't be terrible, but you know, somebody someday is going to come forward and say, well, he wasn't always a nice guy, you know. He could be very critical, you know, or something. Hopefully that'll be the extent of it, right? But everybody has a flaw. Everybody has a limit, you know, even the Dalai Lama. And if he doesn't, it's only because he's done thousands of hours of Zazen. But he too is just a human being. All humans are just human beings. And the dream of getting beyond this, I think, is very destructive. You know, if you're coming in and sitting on the cushion and you want to be perfect, you're going to be disappointed. But, you know, the beautiful thing is that if you just give up on the desire to be perfect, life just becomes a whole lot better. It becomes better. See, it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. Zen is not, I don't think anything is an all or nothing proposition. You know, I have moments on the cushion of perfection. You know, I mean, like, I think to myself, this is perfect. This is heaven. And somebody came up to me on the way to the bathroom, even though we're supposed to have a rule of silence, this person came up to me and he said, wow, I just had an incredible sit. I was so happy. And I was so happy that this guy had a wonderful sit. And, you know, when you have sits like that, the whole issue of perfection just disappears, right? It's like, this is good enough. I don't know if it's perfect or not. This is good enough. This is beautiful. This is wonderful. Now, perfect? I don't know what perfect is, you know, and I don't care. Just let me be in this moment, you know? So this idea of, I think Shinran just went too far. He had a point, you know. These guys were also infected with the idealism of perfection. You know, these monks were sitting on their cushion for 12 hours a day and trying to outsit their opponents and thinking, I'm getting better and better. I'm getting more and more like Buddha. I'm more like Buddha than you are, as a matter of fact. Which is a very un-Buddhistic thing to say, but that's what they were thinking. And of course they put on their beautiful robes and they felt like, now we have arrived, right? So this is like perfection thinking, right? Every day you start from scratch, you know? Every time you sit on the cushion, you're the same old bozo you always were, right? Me, I know that's true. Every time I sit down, I'm the same scrawny, pimply-faced teenager I was 40 years ago, right? Insecure, fearful, uncertain, nervous, sure. I start watching my breath, and the clouds lift sometimes, you know, and I just feel so alive and so wonderful, so grateful to be here. I'm still not perfect, but I'm so happy. Is it better? I'm not perfect, but it's better. It's not perfection, but it's better, right? Better. better. At some point, you know, the whole issue disappears. At some point, you're not practicing to become Buddha anymore. You've given up on that idea because you realize that's a hopeless enterprise. And so what you begin to do is practice because something inside your heart says practice. Right? Something in my heart just told me to practice today. And I came to practice, and I don't expect anything out of it. Certainly not perfection. And then that's heaven itself, isn't it? That's heaven itself. If we listen to our hearts, our kokoro, heart, mind, shin, our shin, you know, we do what our true nature tells us to do. It said, your true nature told you to come here and sit. It didn't say come here and sit in order to become perfect. That's not in the cards. But for some reason it told you to sit, and when you do it, you usually feel better. See? And that's wonderful, isn't it? Isn't better good enough? You know, I think it is. You know, I think it's great. So this is kind of... This is kind of what this koan is all about, right? You know, you have a monk who's got maybe a perfectionitis. You know, I also call this Tibetitis, but there's a Zenitis too. I'm always picking on the Tibetans because everybody always sees the Dalai Lama and says he must be perfect. But in Japan, at one time, people had Zenitis. They thought if I do Zen, I must be getting very perfect. You know, the more zazen I do, the more perfect I am. I think I need a new robe, right? A special robe. With the brocades, layers of brocades that show that I'm perfect. And Shinran said, that is crap. You guys are kidding yourselves. And he was right. But Shinran was wrong to throw the baby out with the bathwater. He wanted it's perfect or nothing, right? And I think that's mistaken too. Better is good. Better is great. Right? So we have this koan where you've got this attendant Wo who has a bad case of Zenitis, Chanitis. He says, you know, I want to be Buddha. I've got to get better. So he's struggling all the time to get better. And the attendant Wo asked Dishan, where have all the sages? What about those great sages, huh? And what about Buddha? What about Bodhidharma? I want to be with those guys, you know, the big shots. And Dishan says, huh? What are you talking about, huh? What was that? And Wo was so disappointed. He said, I want a great utterance from you, you know. I ordered a flying dragon, and all I get is this lame turtle. See, I personally am a lame turtle. See? And it's taken me a lot of zazen to be happy being a lame turtle, but I'm a happy turtle. I really am, you know? And it's because I'm happy being a turtle. You know, it's great. It's great. So Deshan, he says, I wanted you to say something important, and all I got was this. You know, huh? What's that? I ordered a flying dragon. Now a lame tortoise shows up. Deshan just let it go. Struggle away, young man. You know, struggle away. Go on. Next day, Dishan came out of the bath. He's coming out. See, he's just happy to be a turtle. I'm so happy to be. It takes a lot of zazen to be happy being a turtle because there's a part of us that, oh, it so wants to be Buddha. It so wants to be perfect, right? It's a sickness. It's our sickness. We want that perfection, right? And so, but Dishan's done a lot of the zazen, a lot of chan in his life. So, you know, he has a pot belly, he doesn't worry, you know. He has a big nose or a small nose or big ears, or he doesn't. I'm a turtle, I don't worry about stuff like that. Sometimes he, you know, is a little grouchy. He doesn't go, oh my God, grouchiness. Sometimes he's grouchy. If he's grouchy, he sits on the cushion. He says, I was grouchy today, but I feel better now. I'm better. I sat on the cushion. I feel a little better. So he's coming out of the bathhouse. He's just had a bath. He's thinking, I wonder what's for dinner. You know? So here comes Wo again, trying to be Buddha. And he thinks, I've learned something very important from your silence. You know, and he gives him some tea. So Deshaun just pats him on the back. He says, keep going. You're doing fine. You're doing fine, right? Woe says, I think I'm beginning to understand. I think I'm getting perfect. Deshaun says, lets the matter keep going. Keep going. No possibility of perfection. Isn't that wonderful? Shinran had a point too. No possibility of perfection. It's absolutely out of the question. Who ever heard of such a thing? Perfection is such a strange idea that only humans could have invented. Right? It's so far from reality, so far from what we know. So let's not trouble ourselves. Today we came here to practice Zazen. And it was 80 degrees, and I sweated like a horse, and I had a wonderful time, and I'm a little better. And I hope you are too. And I thank you for coming.